This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate Gee. I've created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle and Dr. Jen Hawk, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle and Dr. Hawk analyze and explain the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many, many more. A new episode comes out every other Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you'd like to call in and leave a voicemail question or comment to be read on the show, the U.S. number is 714-900-2601. Or send it in through the website, www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G here, along with Dr. Jen Hawk and Dr. Doug Lyle with the Beat Your Genes podcast. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing this evening?
Good. All's well.
Excellent. We are going solo with you today, and we'll have Dr. Hawk on again together in the next show, but really appreciate you joining us this evening. How's
Jen
life?
Hawk's got a tool belt and a paintbrush on with her hair back in a ponytail, in case anybody wanted to know. She's working on her house in West Virginia, which is just great. So that's all good.
Yeah. And how are you doing over there, Dr. Lyle? Are you
good? I'm lazy. I'm too old to do that kind of stuff. Jen's a lot younger, so she's just brimming with energy and excitement. So that's good. We'll let her give us a report next time.
She's making her heated pool, but once she does have one, she'll be in your situation. So
yeah, all good. All right, let's go. What's happening? You are where?
I'm doing our podcast here. I'm just visiting Florida for a little bit, and and so just right now we're in the midst of Hurricane Ian, and so I'm actually sitting here watching all the waves and all the high open people in their parasailing. They're actually jumping up and down on the waves with the storm at full brim. It's actually really fun to watch. So after this recording, I might go down there and join them.
Oh, that's great. All good. All right. Yeah. All right, Nathan. Well, what do we got?
All right. Our first question. Dear doctors, although addiction has been discussed extensively, already I'm still trying to piece it together. Thus, would like your comments on the following. In a state of anxiety, stress, and depression, where we are getting negative esteem cues and dopamine levels are low, a substance that boosts dopamine might take one from 20 to, say, 80 on a pleasure scale. Whereas if you are content and calm, that substance may take you from a 60 to, say, 70 or 80, which the brain doesn't recognize as a significant increment. So given this, does this mean that people who are sad are much more likely to get addicted to substances? The question then goes on, much like the Harvard study revealed, but I don't know what the Harvard study is.
Yeah, God knows. This person's trying to understand addiction, and so let's look at it from possibly a perspective that quote the Harvard study wasn't quite thinking about. Okay, so let's just try to understand what quote addiction is. I don't exactly see addiction in any separate category apart from motivation. In other words, it's just another. Yeah, it's just another behavior pattern. And so all behavior patterns are secondary to the following basic process. If we're going to look at I might as well. Hey, Jen isn't here, so I don't feel the time constraint and feeling pushed by her tapping her foot. So we're going to go ahead and back the camera. Yeah. There you go. We're going to back the camera up. Okay, so what life forms are is they are devices for the reproduction of DNA. And so what they do in order to do that is they have to acquire resources. So living things are most fundamentally, Richard Dawkins would say they are replicators. I would say they are resource acquisition devices. We would both be right, but we would have our attention focused on slightly different aspects of the life experience. So an oak tree and a jaguar are both fundamentally doing the same thing from both perspectives. They are both here to reproduce DNA, and they are both acquiring resources. Now, it's going to turn out that animals and plants use different strategies for acquiring resources. So a plant, you know, has the architecture of making leaves and soaking up the sun and soaking up nutrients from the soil, etc., and water, either through its leaves or through its roots. Whereas an animal is going to move around to go get resources. So movement is going to, there's two ways, fundamental ways that you can move. You could either move in a random fashion, or you could move in a fashion that is not random. So two choices. So if you're going to move randomly, in principle, there's no, you know, that you could have an animal that's moving randomly, but that would be able to be improved if the resources that that animal seeks have any possibility of being sensed by a sense organ that you can afford to build. So essentially, what animals are is that they are devices to efficiently and as efficiently as possible to acquire resources. That is actually what an animal is. So, and in order to do that, what they have is they've got sense organs that tell them about the nature of the resources that are out there in the world. And that information comes through the energy that comes from the matter or the energetic process. Could be chemical energy through smell and taste, or it could be kinetic energy from being, you know, being tapped on the shoulder or bumping into a table. Or it could be electromagnetic energy in the visual spectrum from light bouncing off of things and then you see objects. So whatever it is, there's a transformation of energy into a perceptual experience. That perceptual experience is then deciphered by the brain in terms of what on earth it is that we are looking at, smelling at, touching, feeling, etc. Okay. And so then those percepts are being evaluated for their mathematical association with gene survival. And so but interestingly enough, the mind doesn't, it isn't actually, you're not seeing little numbers being run inside the brains. What you watch for is actually feelings. So animals have feelings, and what feelings are is feelings are a qualitative analog process of orienting the organism and potentially communicating it to other animals. What the cost-benefit calculus is of the evaluation of that animal's evaluation of their relationship between self and environment. Okay. So the animal's experience, what it is that it feels then, has coming right behind that prescriptions for action. So if it sees something, smells something, hears something, feels something attractive, then it's motivated to move towards that source to make that, to make the stimulus intensity greater. Okay. So you're smelling the pasta and you're almost chomping into it, and you are motivated to stick it in your mouth and chew it, which is going to give you a more intensified version of that sensory experience. All right. Yeah, you see somebody that you feel really attracted to, you don't just stare, or if you're me, you just stare. That's all you do. If you're a normal person, you know, you go up and to chat the girl up, and then if you get lucky, then you get to feel her. Okay. And so, in other words, so we're seeing that what comes behind the perception, the evaluation, the feeling, and then what follows the feelings are actions. So this is the process of, we're actually looking at the motivational dynamics of an animal. And plants don't have motivational dynamics, so we don't even have to talk about that. So it's a redundant thing to say animal motivational process. It's simply motivational process, you know, assumes that we're talking about an animal. Now, so then we have this thing that everybody's interested that they call, quote, addiction. Like, oh, what's that? Okay, that's a bad thing, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, well, what is it? Okay, well, it's just a part of it's a motivational pattern that we see. And why do we see patterns in animal or human behavior? We see patterns because what the animal does in any given moment of its life is it runs a cost-benefit analysis on what is the optimal payoff for, you know, what its options are with respect to the environment. And so it's going to turn out that there are, it doesn't do the animal any good to have a super sophisticated mechanism for understanding the value or danger of different features of the environment if you can't see, touch, feel, hear, etc. Okay, in other words, so you have to have a sensory system that brings the information in, and that information then is evaluated in a universal value system that tells the organism which features of the environment are positive, which are negative, how positive and how negative they are. And then what then will come out of that is a cost-benefit analysis about what to do in our given circumstances. And then we're going to see the feelings, which could be mixed feelings, or sometimes they're not mixed feelings. If there's nothing in the environment, if you're walking into the kitchen, there's nothing in there, you know, other than these, I don't know, freshly baked vegan brownies that are sitting, you know, on the plate. Well, there's no other options that we can see in the environment. And so we look at those options and we're like, oh, okay, pretty good. And so we're motivated to close the distance between us and that resource. Now, so all a pattern of behavior is that the organism finds itself in environmental circumstances that are similar to environmental circumstances that it saw before, and it runs very similar cost-benefit analysis, and it does the same thing. So I've gone to the same Chinese restaurant, you know, of all the Chinese food that I've had in the last 10 years, 97% of it has come at the same Chinese restaurant, and 97% of that has come from exactly the same thing that I've ordered. Why? Because when I contemplate what it is that I want to eat, my mind scans its environment. In this case, there's another feature of animal behavior that's important to understand, and that is it doesn't just have direct sensory evidence of its circumstances, it also has memories. So the memories are actually past experiences that have been recorded. And so what memories do is they enhance the accuracy potentially of the animal's understanding of its relationship between self and environment. What that is it's an improvement over the direct sensory evidence. So the direct sensory evidence, I would look at my office here and all I see is water. There's nothing to eat, and yeah, there's no women here, and I don't see much interesting here. Okay. But my memory says, hey, there's a Chinese restaurant a mile away. And so it's going to turn out that as my mind scans the issues that I might direct my time and attention to, which all of them, the things I would direct my attention to, are associated with gene survival probabilities. That's the only things that organisms value. What values are nothing other than resources that are associated with gene survival. If it's a resource that's not associated with gene survival, then it's not worth anything to you. It's worth something to some other kind of creature, but not you. Okay. So so when we're looking about addiction, what we see is we see a repeated pattern of an individual to use a substance. Okay, that's what we see. And we also see evidence that our subjective view from looking from the outside is that this is not in their best interest. In other words, we believe that there is a net qualitative loss of well-being. So if we were able to objectively score a score sheet on life experience, in other words, taking the moment by moment feeling inside the nervous system on a positive negative dimension, and then to score it literally second by second. If we were to do that, and in principle we could potentially have you know, super fancy 22nd, 23rd century PET scanners that could actually give us an overall qualitative, or actually a quantitative assessment of the well-being of the organism psychologically and potentially physically, okay? So in theory, we could do such a thing. But in reality, instead of doing such a wacko thing, what we're going to do is we're going to talk about the idea that we can subjectively, theoretically report pretty well on sort of a 1 to 100 scale with some reasonable communication about demarking what different things on the scale would mean. We could understand the concept of saying, you know, how close am I to as happy as this organism can possibly get? And so there's going to be, you know, different sets of circumstances we could expect if we looked at this thing like a range of notes on a piano keyboard, where at the very low end, you and your whole family and your, you know, your beloved husband, you're all being eaten by a pack of sharks, you know, off the coast of Maui that was supposed to be a great family vacation. And you're literally hearing them all scream and there's blood in the water and you are being half eaten. That's the lowest note on the thing. That's as bad as it gets. Okay. On the very top side of that piano, the very top note on that thing is like the moment that you met Mr. Right. Okay. So that is like, you know, maybe that's the best moment or something equivalent to that, you know, for most intense orgasm with best partner under the right circumstances, whatever. Okay. So then there's everything, and then all the way to middle C in the middle of this thing that just that feels dull, doesn't feel good, doesn't feel bad, it just feels bland, which is exactly what middle C sounds like to a musician. Sounds like, okay, got it, right in the middle. So the that would be a set of circumstances that you feel neither positive nor negative. You don't feel motivated towards anything, nor are you trying to escape from anything. You don't feel excited. You don't exactly feel bored. You are you're shrugging your shoulders. It's not bad. It's not good. Okay. Now, it's going to turn out that we're going to, if we watch people, we see that their behavior is going to wind up in patterns. It's going to wind up in patterns because there's going to be in their memory systems, they're going to catalog features of their environment and including their experience, obviously their experiences there. And they're going to essentially have a pretty good assay as to what behavioral strategies wind up, you know, with positive versus negative outcomes. And so, and they can assess this quite well. Okay. So they should be able to, it would be essential for an organism to be able to record and catalog the biological value of previous courses of action. And so therefore we're going to find out that, you know, it's no surprise that all the little chicks start running after Farmer John when he heads to the barn, because they have remembered that this is about the time he feeds them. So then it's worth hustling over there and squawking. Okay. So that's why they're doing what they're doing. And we see it over and over again, quote, it's a behavior pattern. And a learning theorist could say, well, it's just conditioning. Well, what the hell do you think it is? Of course, that's what it is. And what is conditioning other than a memory system that's in the organism that is assisting its ability to run cost-benefit analysis on gene survival? Okay, that is what's happening.
Right. So you're saying he can't condition them. He can't condition them.
What's
to
that?
Run. He can't condition them to run into the wolf's house, right? Like,
yeah, right. Well, the point is that the reason I just make a little side swipe at learning theory is because they haven't connected it up to gene survival, okay? And they haven't connected it up really to the fact that the patterns that they see under conditioning paradigms are nothing other than highly stylized and artificially precise processes that are akin to the generalized recording experiences, positive and negative, in animal brains that help the animal essentially make estimations about the nature of its environment and how it should run the cost-benefit analysis in the present circumstances in order to compute the optimal outcome. Now, So now basically what we have is the following: perceptual information in, calculation by an unconscious calculation system that is taking all of the features of the environment and adding to the direct sensory input memories that are associated with everything that needs to be associated to this in order to orient the organism as completely as possible as it calculates a cost-benefit analysis on what would be the next thing to do in the next nanosecond that would optimize gene survival. That's actually what the damn thing is doing. So when we see it using heroin over and over again, okay, all we're really watching is an animal, basically making a resource acquisition choice. That's what it's doing. Okay, now, so the we might say that's a shitty choice, and it's going to turn out that the supernormal stimuli that have been concocted in the last, you know, few centuries, and particularly in the last century or so, the extraordinary supernormal stimuli have a really nasty feature to them that really breeds this, quote, addictive process, i.e. addiction meaning a self-destructive repetitive process. What we see is that some of these substances, they not only are artificially causing extraordinary evidence of tremendous association with gene survival, i.e. a massive dopamine flood that would have only taken place when you are in the middle of an extremely exciting eating or sexual behavior. Those are the only times when you would see dopamine and then subsequent endorphin rushes that high. Okay? So we have an artificial way of achieving that, but the problem is it's more than equivalent to that. In other words, the intensity of the activation of those systems is more intense. It's like light shining in your eye that's brighter than the sun. And so as a result of that, what happens is the brain starts defending itself. It starts shutting down all kinds of capability to even experience that sensation. And then you have a withdrawal process. And so now you're experiencing a lot of shit in between the highs. Okay? Now, this person had a question about, gee, if you're more depressed and therefore it's a higher lift, therefore is it more inherently valuable to you than it is to someone who's not so depressed and therefore the lift isn't as high? That would be an overly simplistic and misleading scheme for trying to understand addiction. You'll have a better understanding of addiction would be the following. It's going to have a high tendency to be associated with high openness. High openness is associated, essentially what high openness is high optimism. And so high open people, you know, go ahead and cross the river and see what's on the other side. Go ahead, go to the other side of the mountain, go to that new city, try the frog's legs, you know what I mean? Even though, you know, the vegans at the table are rolling their eyes and are almost nauseous over the concept, but no, you just got to try it, okay? Why? Because your nervous system is calibrated to saying, hey, the new might be a big win, so I'm going to do it. So highly open people are more likely to try, you know, potentially dangerous stuff. And the dangerous stuff these days can be supernormal stimuli that will give us an artificially intensified signal of biological victory. Well, once you've had that signal, okay, that nervous system now does what with every second of its life? It's searching around for the best biological deal. Where can I get the most chips cost-benefit-wise for per unit of energy? And if it did crack cocaine, you know, an hour ago, and it was the most phenomenal sensory experience of its life, then the problem is it's very likely to be looking for it again soon. Okay? So that would be unrelated to, quote, whether or not it was depressed. So somebody did some Harvard study, whatever that means, and they found out that depressed people are more likely to be addicted, to have addiction problems. Well, you've got a chicken and egg problem there. Remember, the addiction itself is very destructive, so people's lives go in the toilet, so they're depressed about all kinds of things, and then it turns out they're using drugs more. Okay, so did we start from the beginning when nobody used anything, and then experiment and give people a little bit of whatever it was, and then see which ones became more likely to be addicted? We did not. Okay, so whatever that Harvard study was, they put themselves in a position to not understand causality by the very nature of the thing that they're studying. Okay, so how do I look at addiction? I look at addiction as nothing other than the same process of the motivational system making cost-benefit calculations on what it, attempting to try to optimize the qualitative experience of the organism, which is a mirror or analog image of the quantitative variation of gene survival potential in the organism. That's what those feelings are. Okay? That's why more attractive people are more exciting sexually for you to possess, because they contain genes that will create more attractive children who will then be more efficient at getting mates and resources out of potential mates, and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So it is literally an energy conservation system about being efficient to gene survival that is causing you to be more excited about a person who is more what you would consider more sexually attractive. This is all how the motivational system is going to work. It's just like being excited about making $15 an hour moving boxes, and then somebody offering you $22 an hour, you know, three blocks down to do the same thing. Are you excited? You're damn straight you're excited, because you are now acquiring resources more efficiently. Okay? Drug addiction or any kind of addiction is nothing other than the acquisition of resources through the motor behaviors coming as a result of motivational calculus that is nothing other than a calculus mechanism built into every organism in order to use direct sensory inputs and memory systems to orient the organism towards calculating what are the best moves for gene survival. So, you know, what the hell do you do about it? Well, you know, that's a long, convoluted story, but is there anything to this hypothesis that this person is saying, or that these folks guessed about? Possibly. In other words, it wouldn't surprise me at all. In fact, I have some knowledge of this, that the people that are more likely to be alcohol addicted are going to be people who have a higher dopamine reaction to alcohol than people who are less likely to be addicted. So in other words, the signaling device is telling them that it's that resource is more valuable to them than it is to somebody else. That is a near certainty. In other words, as someone who's talked to 1,000 drug addicts in my life, they will tell you, "Oh, I hated methamphetamine, but I loved cocaine the first time I used it." Individual differences in the responsiveness and how these drugs work on an individual brain. So. That of course would never surprise me, but addiction in general, I don't think is likely to be very much of it is going to be laid at the door of I'm depressed and therefore I used and then it gave me a short term bigger boost, etc. I think it's more likely to be at the root of high openness, and actually not too far behind not openness. Independent of that, it's also going to be lower in conscientiousness. Okay, so trust me, there's all kinds of extremely high conscientious drug addicts. Many of them. I've met a whole slew of them. But statistically, I've met an awful lot more people who were drug and alcohol addicts who were low in conscientiousness. Okay, so reasonable high amount of openness, some degree of low conscientiousness, those two combinations will lead to people into this trap. All right. Wonderful. I think that's enough about that.
Wow. So, yeah, it's a lot to think about, but really appreciate it, Dr. Lyle. I love it when you go straight back to the beginning.
Yeah, I hope that was useful for somebody. Yeah. All right. Yeah. All right, what else we got?
All right, our next question. Dear doctors, do you think it would be beneficial to include evolutionary psychology in school curriculums? At what age would children, do you think children would be able to grasp and understand these concepts? And what impact would an awareness of our instincts to grade attractiveness and our genetic constraints of majorly being attracted to people 20% above or below, depending on mating strategy, genetic constraints that have on human relations and our awareness of that have on human relations and behavior? Do you think it would ultimately enrich our life experience?
That's an interesting question. I remember Alan's wife, when I was writing The Pleasure Trap 20 years ago in Alan's house, Jennifer was reading, you know, the chapters, and she would say, oh my God, they should be teaching this in high school. And now I was kind of amused by that. And I thought, you know, the truth is that the big question is, if we subtract the word evolution out of it and just say psychology, because psychology is evolutionary psychology. So, you know, the rest of the world of psychology doesn't know that. They're not sophisticated enough to understand that everything that is true in psychology is true because of evolutionary theory. That is the only way that a psychological mechanism and therefore psychological behavioral pattern process could ever evolve and therefore manifest in any species. So the word evolution is actually redundant. So the question is, does teaching psychology, would it enrich people's lives? And the answer is that information that is true that you don't know will influence cost-benefit analysis that you run in a direction that will lead you to make less mistakes and therefore be more effective at directing your time and energy towards the things that are valuable to you. Okay, so that's why it is that we do this podcast. That's why does anybody listen? Because they at least can sniff that we have the theory right, and that if they listen, we may cover some territory that's useful to them, or they may learn an underlying principle that they're able to apply to a problem that they have in their own lives that will help them more precisely and more accurately analyze the parameters that are involved in them running a cost-benefit analysis and therefore make a better decision with their time and energy that makes their life better. So the answer is, for some people, learning psychology would be of tremendous value because it may stop incredibly expensive mistakes that they would make with their lives. I know that for myself, having read How I Found Freedom in an Unfree World, which is an outstanding self-help book, very systematic thinking and just unusually insightful work, that book has helped me, you know, many, many times make better decisions as my brain consulted the system of thinking that Harry Brown wrote and then sort of filtered my current decisional dilemma through that process and then came up with a better decision. Okay? So in principle, it goes even wider than, quote, does evolutionary psychology be good in school? Then it gets to, well, would psychology be good in school? And then finally, it gets to, is learning useful? And that's what the real question is. Is learning useful? And the answer is yes. Learning can be immensely useful, or it may be trivial. In other words, someone could improve the precision of my knowledge on some topic, but the precision improvement is so trivial that it really wouldn't make any difference. So God knows how much advice is being passed around by fancy would-be coaches on the PGA Tour for trying to get somebody to putt a little bit differently. And the truth is that the way that this guy's thinking about the guy putting might actually be an improvement, but it's so trivial and it would be so difficult to determine if that were true. And there's other things that the guy could do in his game that would be more valuable. The truth is that information, even though it's true, is not worth learning. Okay? So really the question now becomes, is there information in the EP world as it sits today that would be very useful for sort of average human beings learning it? I'm not so sure. I know that there's, I think there is, but probably it would have to be synthesized in the kind of prescriptive decision-making strategies that Jen and I are going to be putting in our book. In other words, we're going to be trying to synthesize down some important, difficult concepts and put it in a way that are highly useful in sort of stereotype clinical situations so that people can really see, if they're in that situation, they can see how the logic works and why it is that we might make a decision that ordinarily you might not make the decision that way. Okay. It's like the equivalent of, last 3 or 4 weeks or something, I got COVID. And I didn't know I had COVID. So I was basically done with COVID by the time I found out it was COVID. But in the first couple of days, I wasn't feeling very good. And so what I did was I fasted. Now, why did I do that? Had I not known about natural hygiene and Alan Goldhammer hadn't been my friend and my friend Nathan Gershfeld wasn't, hadn't fasted a whole 500 people by now and had success with it. In other words, if I wasn't inundated with the knowledge and understanding and experience that I know I don't need to eat for God's sakes. Okay. And then in fact, if I'm sick and I'm trying to get well, probably the smartest thing that I can do is to not eat. Okay. Had I not had that knowledge, I might not have done things the same. I would have survived, but you could see in principle a place where that knowledge might have been the difference between life and death or complete recovery and non-complete recovery. Okay. So I can't think where I'm coming from. Knowledge is useful. High concept is useful. The little thing that this person talked about, like the 20-25 percentile difference of attractiveness, et cetera, people, that's not going to help anybody. Or it's going to be a rare person. It's going to explain to us what we observe in the world so that we understand it. Okay. But I don't know that it's going to change anybody's decision making about anything. So finding out that I'm walking around with a narcissistic chip who's aiming too high and I'm unlikely to be successful. Oh, well. Yeah, you're not going to talk me out of that with some insights from some EP paper that says, well, that's why you're lonely and by yourself your whole damn life is because you got a narcissistic chip like every other human being.
That's why. Oh.
That's what it is. Do I think that there is potentially extremely useful knowledge in the field of psychology that could be very helpful for human beings? Incredibly so. Of course I do. Okay. I live that truth every day on the phone and phone consults. Okay. So I watch my mind that understands psychology very, very well. Talk to people who are very smart, capable people struggling with a decision, and the decision has sufficient complexity and there's sufficient murkiness in their ability to identify the main, value dilemmas, that it helps to have somebody that actually can listen, understand, articulate, and then game out the alternative different scenarios under different sort of parametric combinations and really try to synthesize down through those thought experiments, what are the most important values to you in this decision? Okay. What are the things that we should be protecting, that we should be most protective of first? Okay. That's, and so the knowledge, to help us be better decision makers, that is, that is the march of human progress. So the big, wide, sweeping answer to this question is, of course, would we rather know more about human sexuality and female orgasms and all this sort of stuff? Or would we better be stuck in 1850 where people were like completely and totally ignorant? Okay. And the answer is, of course, we are all better off with the more knowledge we have of all those things. So the yes, the world will slowly and painfully, unless it's taken over by a totalitarian, you know, Davos dictatorship, that the world will continue to work its way very slowly and painfully with tremendous amounts of perverse incentives leveled against the truth. The truth will continue to find its way because it works and it's useful and it aids people's lives and they can see that they make better decisions with it. And so teaching it in school, maybe someday, maybe a little bit, but more likely we're going to find this kind of information in forms that you know have been sort of carefully shaped and presented in ways that people can take it up and make use of it in their decisions in their lives.
Yeah, I remember in psychology, the classes that we had in college, it was like the intro to psychology, and the people who most of my classmates just like would walk out of there saying, okay, whatever. They didn't really find a lot of use to it because it didn't make sense in their own mind. And then the people who did find use to it, they probably went on to, you know, to become psychologists. It felt really useful to them. So I imagine the same thing would be true with EvoPsych, is the people would say, oh, well, whatever. I think that this or that is not true or whatever. It's like just with physics, some people care about physics, some people don't.
Yeah, I think there's a huge individual differences in people's sort of curiosity and what it is that they find valuable. I'm always astounded. I went and visited my sister a few weeks ago, and was starting to have a little bit of discussion about some very interesting principles in psychology that I'm describing in my book. And you just watch the eyes glaze over with no interest.
Yeah.
And that's a very intelligent human. It just couldn't give a damn. And it's amazing. You know, it's I'm more interested in her gardening than she is in psychology.
The life,
which is
what's
amazing
going on,
to me.
How to understand life.
Yeah. I mean, it's enough to make one nonplussed because we sit, my sister and I sit at literally opposite ends of the bell curve on psychological mindedness. This is extraordinary, the individual differences. And, you know, you look at extraordinary individual differences, not only between people, not only what they look like, what their interests are, what their talents and capabilities are, but you also look at pets. You know, no two dogs are that much alike. Some of them are, but if you got two dogs in the family, they are quite different in their personalities. So people, what people find interesting, what they feel like might be important for them to learn, huge individual differences there. But it's hard to see a future where the principles of evolutionary psychology won't be better and better distilled into daily decision-making aids. Hard to believe that that isn't going to be true based on the extraordinary power that I have seen in this sort of enlightenment ability to actually improve people's choices and improve their lives. So, you know, it's coming, but it reminds me to some extent as diet did. So, I mean, I learned about the importance of diet in the late 1970s, and long before the word vegan appeared anywhere. And so I knew, you know, about the value of the quality of food, you know, from a young age. And the world has very, very, very slowly drifted towards me. Okay, so not hugely and not mostly, but certainly the percentage of people that have an awareness and interest in the way that I would see things in that domain is probably, you know, it went from 1 in 300 to 2 in 100. So it's up 6 to 1 in 40 years, which is no small change. And the same thing is going to be true of EvoPsych. In other words, these principles, they will be increasingly useful. We can't foretell the future and see what could happen with EvoPsych. So Jen and I have plans to make some of the utility of these things possibly extremely useful to very, very wide audiences in the future, and not out there in the way distant future either. So we may, it is possible that myself and some other people may wind up actually sharing this gold with the world in ways that the world can see it shine. So we'll see.
Well, Dr. Lau, we're looking forward to it. So it's been a long time coming. I know even just we started this podcast a little over 6 years ago. And I remember back then, I know you were much more bold than I was, but I didn't even want to use my first my first and last name fully because I was nervous about some sort of, total overestimate. Sure. It's like, how important are we with our 30 listeners? But I just thought I didn't want to jeopardize somebody, takes things the wrong way and just all of a sudden they cancel us or try to do some
shit. Upset.
But nowadays it's like everybody's using the Big Five, and there's now multiple podcasts discussing this kind of thing. Jeffrey Miller's been on Joe Rogan. I mean, it's these things are much more mainstream than they were before. So,
right. Yeah. The world's coming towards us, which is good. Yep.
All right, Dr. Lau, do you want to do one more question?
Yeah, let's do one more. What the heck?
Okay. Dear doctors, my dad was a smoker in his 20s, and my mom told me that he gave it up after the birth of my elder sister. However, growing up, I remember that there was a sealed packet of cigarettes in a certain drawer that never moved, which my dad had kept to remind himself of the fact that he had quit and to practice willpower. After learning about channel factors, this seems actually like a stupid decision in retrospect. What would be your comments on this?
Yeah, it's a stupid decision. He got away with it. And the reason he got away with it is because the actual signal that, remember, as I explained in question number one tonight, and that what an animal is a resource acquisition device. And so it's going to turn out that how hard you fight for a resource and how much effort you put into getting it are largely dependent upon your perceived probability of success that you can get it. The likelihood that you can get it and your perceived probability of success is largely determined by your memory systems as you review how recently you acquired the resource. So you have a resource acquisition algorithm, and that algorithm is going to say, well, how long since we had the resource? If the resource was obtained yesterday, then it's exceedingly likely that you could get it today. And if you get it today, then when tomorrow comes, it's exceedingly likely that you're going to feel like tomorrow it's worth putting out effort to get the resource. Now, so this actually is a great question because it's going to tear the lid off a misunderstanding that a great many people have about addiction and addiction process. People believe that the reason they have an addiction or addiction process is because, they've got some holes in their soul and this and that problem and et cetera. And then if they work on their issues and jump through all these hoops, then they'll build up this sort of resilience. Okay. Very reasonable and understandable inferences. I think that conceptualization of what's happening there is, it may not be 100% wrong, but it's awfully close. Instead, what has happened is the person has abstained for long enough that they have, that the resource acquisition algorithm has determined that the resource is not easily available. Now, you might say, well, how the hell can that be? The alcoholic knows quite well they can go into the liquor store and get the material. Ah, that is not the same thing as experiencing the sensory event. The experience of the sensory event is the Stone Age cue that the resource is available. When you smell food, that is the Stone Age cue. Not that you see a loaf of bread up on a shelf. That is not a Stone Age cue. Okay? So this is the issue. The question isn't how well you can defend yourself when you don't have any Stone Age cues around. The question is, what the hell happens to you when you get a Stone Age cue? If you get, someone who's an alcoholic and hasn't had a drink in 7 months, if you talk to them, what they may be thinking is, well, you know, I'm in good shape. I haven't had hardly any cravings at all in the last 6 months. So they can feel like, based on our cultural, widely held understanding of the problem, they could reasonably be inferring that they have transcended much of their personal demons. And that is the reason they are not having the cravings. And that now, if somebody offers them a glass of wine at a party, their Stone Age brain rapidly calculates the cost-benefit analysis. It recognizes a resource. It can now smell it, for God's sakes. It's being offered for free. It would actually be socially costly to possibly refuse it. And now they are in a momentary problem running a cost-benefit analysis. And one of the parameter estimations of the cost-benefit analysis is, oh, aren't we an alcoholic? Isn't all hell going to break loose? And their nervous system says, well, I don't know what that is, whatever it is that is, because whatever it is, I must have healed myself because I haven't had a craving in 6 months. Okay? So now they take a drink, and what do they find out? There is no transcendence of shit. This is a supernormal stimuli, and you've got a genetically built nervous system to all hell's going to break loose. You weren't protected by a process of the development of some willpower process. Nothing of the kind took place. You're like a newborn baby. You're a resource acquisition device that just found the resource. Okay? So you've now coached the brain that is back available again. So that's the problem there. So to having the cigarette pack in the drawer, that person was thinking that having it in the drawer and then not taking the cigarette was sort of, you know, a developmental process of displaying and reaffirming their willpower. Not really. The thing is that pack of cigarettes is not a direct sensory evidence that the resource is available, but it's putting it a little closer. Okay? So it's getting it just that much closer. Now, the thing is that the real threat would have been some attractive person offering them a cigarette standing outside, you know, waiting for a bus somewhere. Now we're in trouble. Okay? Because now they're thinking, well, I've got all this willpower. I've built up all this resilience. If I have a cigarette now, what's the big deal? I must not have that problem anymore because I beat it. Okay? Rather than understanding, oh no, you haven't beaten anything. All that's happened is that the resource acquisition algorithm has been inferring that the resource is not available. Okay? As soon as you take a puff of that smoke, it now knows that resource is available. You're back in. So this understanding of the availability or inavailability, according to the Stone Age brain, of the resource and therefore its probability of acquisition, this is why after you go abstinent for 3 or 4 weeks on just about anything, you're going to start thinking about it less and less and less and less and less and less and less. That's because the Stone Age brain running a resource acquisition algorithm program is inferring that that resource is now not in the environment. Okay, so therefore it's not worth the time and energy to draw that up from memory systems in order to calculate whether it's worth the energy to go to find that resource, because if we haven't had it for a while, it's probably not available. Okay, so anyway, I forget what on earth the question was. Oh, the cigarettes in the drawer. Yeah, the cigarettes in the drawer. Yes, that person increased by 10 or 20 or 30% the odds of a relapse tragedy. Okay, so they thought the process was somehow adding to their somehow willpower by, you know, looking at it and then pushing it out of there. They didn't know that it's actually reasonably easy to push that away because of the fact that they weren't getting a direct sensory evidence. They were getting a correlate, okay, that doesn't have near the potency. So the so that's actually what happened there. And so the questioner's intuition is correct. That was giving oneself unnecessary channel factor risk. Don't do it. If you're an alcoholic, don't keep a wine bottle around. That is, you know, to remind yourself of your victory over alcohol, and therefore, you know, a sense of pride that you, you know, have not indulged. That is a mistake. Okay. Good question. Very good question.
Dr. Lau, thank you so much. Really, really appreciate it. So just, you know, I learned something new every show, and it's been almost 300 and I've never gotten bored a single show. So it's really, really fascinating. So.
Fabulous. All right, Nathan, all good. And we'll be back with the whole gang next time.
Absolutely. Have a good one, Dr. Lau. All right. Have a good night.
Gotcha. All right. Thank you. Bye.
Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G., Dr. Lyle, and Dr. Hawk with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.